The Touching the Trail Podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Touching the Trail Podcast, our weekly ritual of peace, presence, and perseverance. This week's episode is episode 179 with this week's guest, Scott Johnston. But before we jump into who Scott is and my conversation with him, I just have to take care of a little business. Now, there are two ways that you can support Touching the Trail. The first is that you can go to touchingthetrail.com/donate to donate to the show. And the second way is that you can go to targetreleaserecovery.com to pick up your very own Basecamp and Peak handheld deep tissue massage tools. And both those links are in the show notes. Now, Scott Johnston, along with his co-author Steve House, is the author of Training for the New Alpinism, A Manual for the Climber as Athlete, and is the author of Training for the Uphill Athlete, A Manual for Mountain Runners and Ski Mountaineers. And he's the co-founder of the coaching company Uphill Athlete. And I first heard about Scott and Steve by hearing about Training for the New Alpinism, which came out in 2014. And that book really changed the training landscape for alpinism and really endurance sports in general by applying tried and true training techniques from more conventional sports to endurance sports. And with their new book, Training for the Uphill Athlete, which came out just this year, they are really continuing to shift the sport's perspective on training for the better and in this new kind of viewpoint that they've been developing with Scott's training kind of framework that he has, which we delve into today. We delve into Scott's story today, and we delve into what training is to him and how to look at what training is so that you can progress as an athlete. And I really enjoyed this conversation with him. I learned a lot about how to look at my training, how to look at how I approach what I do physically outdoors, and how to best reap the benefits and the rewards from it so that I can progress towards the goals that I have. And I hope that it helps you do the same in today's conversation with Scott Johnston. Please enjoy. Well, actually, that is a perfect lead into kind of the first question I had, so we might as well kind of jump into it.
Okay.
But the first question I had, you know, is really just about your climbing, and you mentioned your little bio on Uphill Athlete about how, you know, you had all these amazing climbers in Boulder at the time when you were growing up and in high school. So I'm curious how growing up in Boulder and, you know, by the Rockies and in Colorado in general shaped your passion for climbing and the outdoors in general, and kind of how that developed as you kind of grew in that scene, I guess.
Sure. Well, I think you probably also know I was involved in a conventional sport. I was a swimmer all through my youth and high school and college. And that was, you know, pretty mainstream. It was, you know, very regimented and controlled, you know, lots of hard work, of course, and, you know, two workouts a day, getting, you know, being in the pool at 5:30 in the morning, and then after school in the afternoons. And so I think climbing for me represented a way out, you know, something that wasn't so controlled. It wasn't, it was just like you could make it whatever you wanted it to be. There were no coaches and parents, and, you know, in fact, I had to hide my climbing from my parents. They didn't know that I was involved in climbing until later in college. They finally figured it out. And it was, you know, it was pretty much a counterculture type of activity then. It was what people who didn't fit in, and not that I didn't fit in, I think I fit in pretty well, but I was drawn to that sort of counterculture aspect of it. This is what you did to rebel. This is what you did that your parents didn't want you to do. And, you know, we were going out and we didn't know what we were doing when we first started, high school buddies and myself. And it's a wonder we didn't kill ourselves. And I mean, any parent in their right mind would have been aghast at what we were doing. But anyway, it was a great learning opportunity for me. And I did have, you know, lots of inspirational folk heroes living in the Boulder area, climbing at a very high level, not only just locally, but, you know, even nationally and internationally. And that definitely influenced me. I, you know, was in a period of like most young men in that period of your life, you know, you're drawn to these sort of bigger than life heroic figures, and they're very inspirational. You are in a stage where you're dreaming about, you know, what you could be doing, and so that was really influential in my life for sure. And the longer I stayed, you know, with swimming, which lasted through college, the more disenchanted I became with it. You know, I got tired of spending 5 hours a day in a pool looking at the bottom of the lane line. And when I would get outdoors, whether it was, you know, going skiing in the mountains or climbing and that sort of thing, I just realized this is what I like to do. But I did have a pretty darn good fitness base from all my years of training. And that allowed me to, you know, keep up with better people and progress at probably at a somewhat faster rate than some people could have. So I was always a game partner. So I would frequently tag along with better climbers because, you know, I was willing to go along with them even if the climb was over my head. And so I kind of got swept up in that sort of thing, and then I began to develop some of my own climbing, ethos, perhaps is too strong a word, but, you know, I'd got a direction in my climbing that I wanted to go. I liked being in big mountains on alpine type routes, and maybe it was because I was never a particularly good rock climber. I thought I could do this other stuff, and it wasn't quite as technically demanding. So anyway, that's sort of the story up through my, teens and 20s and 30s probably.
Mm-hmm. Are you, grateful now for the swimming? Like, would you see that it taught you certain things that you benefited from? Or is it something that you're like, yeah, it was, I mean, where you kind of, where's your stance now on spending all those years in the pool training that hard?
I think it was really good. I think mm-hmm. there's a tremendous amount of discipline that comes along with that in young people who, you know, have to be, they're forced to get up at 5 o'clock so they can be at practice every morning.
Right.
It's swimming is a very, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, any of these sports can be hard, but right. swimming is a very, you know, when you have kids, you know, teenagers training 5 hours a day, that is a lot of time to devote to something like this. And so I think it taught me a lot. It obviously benefited me physically, but I think it was good for me mentally because you just, as you know, being a runner, you know, most of these endurance sports are about suffering.
Yeah.
And, you know, how well can you endure the suffering? And, you know, when you're in the pool and you're gasping between, you know, interval repetitions and the coach is saying, okay, 5 more of those and you're going to drop the time 3 seconds per 100 meters. And you're going, oh my God, how am I going to do this? And somehow you figure out a way to do it. And so I think there's some real advantages. And I also believe, you know, I've come to realize over now, you know, I'm 65 years old now and I have coached for a long time, that what kids do through those teenage years, I think especially through the years of puberty, has a dramatic effect on the rest of their life in terms of, if they're sitting on a couch doing nothing, then they're not going to develop a lot of those physical attributes that would make a good athlete in their, you know, late middle life. Whereas if they've been super active in sports, especially endurance sports, then they're going to have that base that they developed in those years when their body was its most plastic, you know, most malleable. And I've just seen it many, many times over where, you know, somebody ran cross country in high school and then they didn't do very much through their 20s and they come back in the 30s and boom, they can jump off the couch and they can, you know, they can still run a 17-minute 5K.
Right.
And so I think that there's something to that. And so I believe that that's a pretty critical time in the overall athletic development of a person as to what they've done. I mean, if you have a kid who was a great gymnast as a child, they could probably be a really good rock climber,
right.
just because they're going to have all those basic strengths and flexibilities and the kinesthetics and all that awareness will have already been inculcated into their body when at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this school that I'm at right now, this college, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, is my number one school. And I have been thinking about it that I don't know if I would have gotten into this school if it wasn't for running, in the sense of what, ultra running taught me in terms of discipline And I got into running about halfway through high school, and you know, coming into the end of high school when you have to start studying for SATs and applying to colleges and all the other, and I was an Eagle Scout, I was working towards an Eagle Scout, and I didn't want to finish it. I had been kind of done with Scouts, and the studying for the SATs was, you know, tedious and annoying. But applying all of the, you know, thousands of miles I've been putting on my legs outside of school, I was able to learn how to be disciplined in those other arenas. And that's something I've been thinking about recently, you know, in hindsight, I guess, to just a few years ago.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a transfer over to that. Interestingly, so I was on track to Eagle Scout. I was almost to my Eagle badge when, like you, you know, in my teenage years, other things like swimming and climbing just became more important for me, and I never finished it. Steve, on the other hand, who I think you're going to interview, did become an Eagle Scout.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of, it's interesting that all three of us have that background.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I was at a bike race just hanging out, Sea Otter, if you know what that is. It's, it happens in water. Yes. Yeah. With the cycling team here on campus, and we were, you know, some of the guys were racing, but most of us were just hanging out, and we were trying to light the fire and the campfire in the evening, and everybody was like, okay, we need like some Boy Scouts, and some dude was like, I'm an Eagle Scout, and I was like, oh, I am too, and they're like, okay, you got fire duty. So we had like campfire duty the whole weekend.
some very worthwhile skill came out of their scouting experience.
Yeah.
I know a lot of other good things came out of it too. That's tongue in cheek.
So was your finding, you know, your passion for the outdoors and for climbing, was that kind of the reason why you shifted from swimming into cross-country skiing after college?
Yeah. So when it was a very strange coincidence. My uncle was a ski jumping coach. And so all of us kids had to jump. It was just like, you have to go jump. That's what you do. And jumping is another one of those sports that you kind of need to learn, start when you're really young, because you have to be fearless and you have to develop that, the abilities. It's a lot easier to learn it when you're, you know, 8 to 12 years old than to try to learn it when you're 20. And so I'd been exposed to skiing, you know, Nordic skiing, although it was jumping, which is still a Nordic discipline, but it's was different. But then when I was at the University of Colorado on the swim team, interestingly and strangely enough, the swimmers and the cross-country ski team shared the same locker room.
Oh.
And at that time, virtually every skier at a big NCAA school was imported from Norway. There was very, very few Americans because people didn't have the skill set, the talent and all that. So these big schools, especially ones like University of Colorado that were vying for national championships, would just go to Norway and recruit these often guys in their 20s who had, you know, made a shot at the World Cup and not been super successful. And so they realized, okay, I'm not going to go to the Olympics for Norway. I'm going to instead go get a great education in the United States. And so these guys would be, you know, 22, 23 years old, and have had, you know, several years on the World Cup. Like, these were really high level athletes. And I got to be buddies with a couple of those guys in the locker room, and so they took me out skiing and showed me skiing, and I just thought, whoa, this is so much cooler than swimming. You know, we're outdoors and you go uphill and downhill, and you don't have to worry about getting all these sinus infections from dirty water in the pool and chlorine. And it was just like a revelation to me that you could. I had run cross country in high school, but that was only to get in shape for swimming season. I never really did it with any serious competition in mind. But this whole notion that there's this other outdoor sport that was really wonderful was quite liberating. And so I started going out, and these guys found out I was pretty tough. And so they taught me how to ski. And I spent literally hundreds of kilometers just following them, matching them stride for stride, trying to learn everything I could for them. And I learned a lot about training because these guys had come out of these really high level training programs. And they knew, even if they might not be able to explain the physiology, they knew why they did what they did, and they told me, you know, here's how you train, here's what you do. And I would soak it all up like a sponge. And so very quickly, I just sort of it was a natural transition into skiing.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to kind of pair that with climbing or with any other outdoor endeavors, or did you kind of keep
them? Yeah, I was still climbing pretty active, quite actively at the time, all through my entire ski career, which lasted through the 80s, late 70s to late 80s. I was climbing and ski racing. So even when I would be traveling to World Cup races or traveling around to races and knowing that I have to, for instance, in my summer off-season training would often involve running around in the mountains and climbing stuff, you know, unrope, just, you know, third-class, easy scrambling stuff, but spending long days in the big mountains as training base. So I was able to combine the two, and I also did quite a lot of harder climbing at that time. I traveled to Europe and Canada quite a bit for climbing. So it wasn't, I mean, I think if perhaps I was too much of a polymath, you know, I probably should have just focused on one thing or the other, but they both were so great for me and I learned a lot. So I don't have any regrets, but I don't think I ever exploited my full potential because I was too torn. You know, if somebody was going to go on a big climb and they invited me to go, I'd do that. And then I would kind of blow off training for skiing when I was doing that.
But I did read that you had these aspirations for your climbing career, focus, whatever you want to call it. But then you had an accident in Alaska that kind of refocused or reset your, what you had dreamed about in climbing. I'm curious, you know, kind of what happened there and how that impacted your journey.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was, you know, it was a life and death type of situation. And when you have those watershed moments, I mean, after my accident, I wasn't sure, and neither were the doctors, that I would ever walk without a cane again. Because I fell and got badly hurt. I was by myself. Mm-hmm. And then I spent 2 days crawling down a glacier by myself to where the airplane was going to pick me up. And then I spent another 5 days waiting on the glacier after I radioed out because the clouds were too low and they couldn't fly in. And the whole time I didn't even have an aspirin with me, so, let alone any kind of hardcore pain meds. So I'm just lying there, you know, for days on end, thinking, God, what have I done to myself? And I'm so messed up, you know, I couldn't walk, I couldn't stand. It definitely gives you pause and makes you think, you know, that up till that time I was, you know, thinking I'm going to be the next Reinhold Messner. And then when this happened, you know, first of all, I had no idea what I'd done to myself. I was just all beat up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how many I'd have to have all these surgeries to get repaired and get functional. And then I had just graduated from the university with my degree in engineering and math. And so when I went back, and I had no intention of being an engineer, that was like the last thing on my mind. I was going to be a professional climber, even though professional climbers, there was only probably two or three in the whole world, but I was convinced I could be one of those. And so when I got back to Colorado and I got patched up by the doc and he gave me this terrible news, you know, you may never walk right again. I sort of had to reshift, and I thought, oh, I guess I, and I had no money. I didn't even have any insurance to cover this for the accident. And so I thought, okay, I guess I'm gonna have to go to work as an engineer. I got my first job as an engineer, and you know, I promised my father I would stay a year because he said, you got to give it a year and see if it's going to work out, because he knew I wasn't the engineering type. And I lasted 1 year and 1 day before I left. But anyway, so that, yeah, that did, that accident was a key turning point in my life. I think when you come face to face with that serious of a situation, and you know, my risk tolerance from then on was nowhere near what it had been up to that point. And I just realized how easily I could have been killed. And so that changed things. I still kept climbing, and I went to the Himalayas, I went to the Karakoram, and I climbed other big mountains and climbed other hard routes, but I wasn't as driven anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was also when I was ski racing. I think so ski racing could probably play took a little bit bigger role, because even though it's very hard, it's not risky.
Right.
And I really got into the training for skiing because I thought there's no way I'm going to be a cripple the rest of my life. Because I was convinced that what the doc told me, and he was a very good orthopedic surgeon, but orthopedic surgery in the 70s was nothing like it is today. So, you know, I was in a full length cast from my crotch to my toes on my right leg for over 6 months.
Whoa.
And wow. Of course, by the time they took it off, I could encircle my upper thigh and have my thumbs overlap by 2 or 3 inches. I was just, my leg was just shriveled up to nothing.
Yeah.
And it took a long, long time to get where I could even bend my knee and get to where I could ride a bicycle and then start running again. And skiing really provided a vehicle for me to do that, you know, and the motivation to get out there and do it so I could start training and getting better at it.
Mm-hmm. And as you were, you know, after the doctor told you that news of that you were, you know, may never walk without a cane again and you're lying in that hospital bed, I mean, did you immediately start to try to, like, you know, tell yourself, like, no, that's not how this is going to go. I'm going to get back out there in some way. Or were you kind of processing, almost resigning yourself to it? I mean, where were you?
Like, well, the first 10 days I was so out of it on morphine mm-hmm. that I had no coherent thoughts at all. But when I got out of the hospital and I, you know, was crutching around, I got back to Boulder and started, you know, back with my friends, and they were great. They would say, hey, we're going to go for a hike. Why don't you go with us? And so we would hike on the Mesa Trail. We'd climb, hike up Flagstaff Mountain, and I'd be on my crutches, you know, with this big, huge cast. And I'd go out there for 5 miles with them, and they'd wait for me. And it was all a big, funny thing at the time. But I think it helped me go, okay, I can do this. I can not have to be crippled. And as soon as I got my leg out of the cast, the first thing I did was I got on a bicycle. And I could only stand up because I didn't have enough flexibility to sit down on the bike. I just started riding standing up all the time because my knee wouldn't bend that far. But gradually the scar tissue and adhesions broke down. And I was able to, you know, sit down on the bike. And then after a while I could run. And then that winter I was able to ski. And then I thought, okay, I can prove this guy wrong. And I think it took me a while to come to the conclusion that, oh, I actually can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it hasn't, you know, it's obviously been an impairment for all these years, but I don't think it held me back from too much.
Right. And yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I've never had an injury anywhere that bad, obviously, but just from the injuries that I've gotten from running, you know, the thing that I've noticed, and which seems like you've noticed as well from what you've been saying, is to me that, you know, injury is so much of a mindset of how you approach it, that, you know, if you had been got out of that hospital and, you know, told your friends, like, no, look, I have this cast on, I can't go, and you know, resigned yourself to it or said, I'm injured, you know, and this isn't going to change or something, you know, how it depends so much on how you look at it, at least is what I've noticed, and how you shift your perspective on it can impact so much of where it leads.
I think that's very true. And I think that, you know, part of it was, I mean, I had youth on my side. I was only 25 years old. And I was, you know, scared to death of spending the rest of my life as a cripple when I'd had this super active life. And basically up to that point, you know, if I wanted to climb a mountain or go run on some long run in the mountains or ski something or swim across the lake or whatever, I could do anything I wanted to do. I was like most 20-something young men. I was immortal. There's nothing I could do, or nothing that I couldn't do, let's say. And this all of a sudden gave me a dose of reality, slap in the face, so to speak. And I think that one of the things that I have a little poster in my gym here that I train a lot of athletes in, and the poster says, never let someone else set your limits. And I think that what happens oftentimes is that people who, through their own experience, have realized that they couldn't do something, when they're in a position of authority with other people, whether it's a doctor or a coach or whomever, says, oh, you won't be able to do that because I couldn't do it, or I've never seen it done, or whatever, I think it's very easy for us to accept that and say, oh, I'm not even going to try because this guy who I respect and has all this authority just told me that it's impossible. And I was probably too stupid or too, let's say, I was too full of myself to believe that that would be the case. But again, I think that's where, like, if that had happened when I was 45 or 50, I might not have had the mojo to, you know, put that much effort into it.
Right.
It's something you have that's a gift of youth, to have that sort of, you know, you're too stupid to know that you shouldn't do this kind of thing.
Right. And so, you know, you start working for this year at this engineering company, and then I read that you even eventually started your own engineering firm.
I did.
And I'm curious, you know, how you balanced, you know, your outdoor passions with, you know, job, business, obviously running your own business, and how that kind of, you know, equated itself over that time of your life.
Yeah, that was tricky balancing. I mean, it was no problem. The year that I worked at the aerospace engineering firm was easy, because I was so injured. There was, you know, riding my bike to work was a big deal. And
right.
I wasn't able to do very much during that course of that year, so I didn't miss out on a lot. The way I came to start my own business was, I heard that one of my former professors at the university was getting married, and so I called him to congratulate him. And he asked me how I was liking work. And I said, oh, God, Frank, I hate it. I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm doing this and feel like I'm just prostituting myself. And he said, well, why don't you come to work for me? I'm quitting the university and going to branch out and do this other thing. And I said, oh, you're kidding. Could I do that? But I could have a month off to go climbing before we do it. And he said, sure. And so then we started this engineering firm that grew pretty dramatically. And so then I was sort of one of the bosses. There were three partners in this firm, and we had a number of employees, and we had big contracts. And so it had a lot of obligations, but I could fit a lot of my training for skiing and my more recreationally focused climbing around that pretty well. Eventually, it did become an impediment. And so after a number of years, sometime in the mid to late 80s, I sold my share of the business, because I was traveling to Europe for ski racing and going to training camps several times a year, and I didn't feel good about being a partner in this. And so initially what we did was, we set it up so that I just received a salary like I was an employee, and I got no profit sharing or anything else, because I just didn't feel like I deserved that. And eventually it got to the point where I didn't even feel good taking a salary. and so I worked as a consultant for them for a couple of years while I was ski racing, but I didn't really have a principal role in the business. And then I just sort of faded out of it. But it certainly is a challenge. I mean, I can see it, you know, now Steve and I have a burgeoning business, and we have 8 other coaches besides ourselves that we're working with, and hundreds of customers, that my personal time for training and climbing, skiing, whatever it is much reduced. And so it's a tricky balance for
right.
sure.
Do you think that, I mean,
something has to give?
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that your ability to balance it as best you can has been, you know, informed and shaped by all the years that you spent you know, in high school and in college, training hard and balancing school and everything else, and the kind of that background in balance?
Yeah, I would say it does, but that's not the principal factor. And I'll
right.
give you a little secret that in 40 years you're going to be dealing with, and that is, like, I can't train as much or as hard or as long or as big as I did, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It just can't happen.
Right.
And so I have. If I had all the time in the world to go out and train, either I would be just a completely destroyed wreck, or, you know, I don't know what I would do. I don't need that much time anymore. It's not like I need 25 hours a week of physical activity like I did, you know, when I was closer to your age. So I think, you know, for me, this has actually come at a fairly good time in my life, when if I didn't have this, the intellectual challenge of running the business and managing all the stuff that we have going on, I'd be a retired old guy right now. And that wouldn't feel very good. And so this has actually worked out well in for my age, mm-hmm. I think. It's but you're right that certainly the discipline, and, you know, I know that I could get up in the morning and get out the door, and if I'm going to get a run in, I got to get out there at 6:30 so I can get back in time to answer dozens of emails and that kind of thing. So I am that structure that discipline that I developed as a young person, I think has paid off for sure.
Right. So eventually, you shifted out of the engineering firm and eventually decided to move to Washington. I'm curious about, how that impacted, your day-to-day life and your life in general and the reason why, and just kind of talk about moving into this, outdoor focused community and away from, working as an engineer.
Yeah. So the, when I was ski racing, I was traveling around quite a lot. And at that time, the U.S. Nordic cross country ski team was based out of Bend, Oregon. And the reason for that was that Bend had snow 10 months of the year. We could ski almost 10 months of the year there because the snowpack was so deep. And so I was going there frequently for training. And Boulder, where I had been living for a long time, had gotten so crowded that by 1986, my wife and I said, we're out of here. We just can't stand the crowds in Boulder. And so we moved to Bend, which was a tiny little place. All the lumber mills had just shut down and there was nothing going on there. And I was doing all this training, so it was a great opportunity for me to be there and train. It was a very cheap place to live. The town now is like probably 150,000 people. When we moved there, it was 16,000 people. So it was tiny. There was the real estate didn't sell in that town because there was no market for it because the mills were shut down. So it was quite a depressed area, but it was a beautiful place, although it didn't really have mountains. The mountains I liked, it had these volcanoes, but they weren't very interesting from a climbing or skiing standpoint. And so my wife and I almost immediately began making pilgrimages up to the North Cascades in North Central Washington to climb and to ski in the wintertime. And really fell in love with the place, but I was so enmeshed in what I was doing that it took us a number of years to finally extricate ourselves out of Bend and make the move here in 1999. And that's when I met Steve. When I moved here, he was living here, he was guiding here, working both for the climbing guide service and the heli-ski guide service. And we became good friends and started doing a lot of climbing together and skiing in the wintertime together. And that's sort of the genesis of the story of how he and I got to working together.
Mm-hmm. And now kind of take a pause here of something of this whole story that I kind of have missed, I guess, in asking you before we move into your relationship with Steve and how that, has moved forward in the years since. I'm curious about how throughout all of what we've talked about, from high school and swimming into college into the accident, into engineering, into all of this, you always have had this passion and this fascination with training and with studying it and learning about it on your own. And I'm curious how that developed and how you kept that going throughout your life and learning more and more about that and kind of always, having that, it seems like from at least what I was reading, it was always there for you into this move to Washington.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it didn't play a role in the move to Washington, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, like, into this part of your life.
Even as a high school kid, I was lucky that I had exposure to some very high-level coaches as a swimmer and then later as a skier, but mostly as a swimmer. And when I was swimming, I had a high school coach that was really into the science of training, and he gave us, every year, he would give us this big, like a loose-leaf notebook, and we had to study it and be able to explain to him, the physiology of, metabolism and endurance and, fast twitch muscle fibers. I mean, this was all stuff that he thought was really important for us. So I got this exposure as a teenager, and it fostered questions in me. Because I swam at a fairly high level, I was part of an Olympic development program based out of the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs for a while. And I was getting tested frequently, and of course at that time they didn't do any swimming tests. We had to run on a treadmill, which isn't the ideal way to test a swimmer because it's not very sport specific for them. But I had really high, good results in these tests. But I would ask the coaches and the testers, like, so, okay, well, if I'm this good, how come I'm not the champion? If all that really matters is max VO2, which is at the time what everybody would say, how come I'm not world champion? And nobody had a good answer for me. And same thing happened when I was skiing. And I'd say, wait a minute, if what we're trying to do is improve these athletes' max VO2, and mine's already up there with the best guys in the world, how come I'm not beating all these other guys that are have a lower max VO2 than me? And again, I couldn't get good explanations, and so I started reading more and trying to understand this, because it seemed like there's these, and maybe you've seen this too in your, I don't know what your educational background is, but I think for a lot of lay people who are interested in the science of training, there's not a lot of coherent information.
No.
There's little data points scattered around the universe that you can pick up a little of this and a little of that, but nobody had really kind of pulled it all together and presented it to at a layperson level. So I was just going out there and, you know, grabbing a little bit from this coach, reading somebody's book and doing that, or reading on a blog, or just trying to put all these pieces together, and then slowly the picture started to form, and I go, oh, that's why my coaches used to tell me we should do blah blah blah, and I would understand, you know, it took, but I don't think my coaches necessarily knew, they were following a formula, but I started to be able to put those pieces together after, you know, having been an athlete and experimented on myself, but also having this now, again, mostly a lay person's knowledge. I don't have a background in biochemistry or anything like that, but I could get enough of it to understand, okay, this is why, for instance, this basic aerobic capacity that we talk so much about in our book and on our website, that's why that's important. It's not necessarily the thing that makes you faster, but it's the thing that supports the training that makes you faster. And, you know, so it plays this critical role that, you know, when we talk about, you know, you need to go out and run 100 miles, you're going to run a marathon, well, you should be running 80 to 100 miles a week if you want to have a good performance. We know that pretty well. Well, why is that? Why does all this easy training make you faster? And nobody seemed to have a very good answer for that. And, you know, again, putting some pieces together and finding little bits and chunks here and there, I began to go, oh, that's... So I created what I call my own little intellectual framework of how these systems work together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started using it in my own coaching, because I was coaching cross-country skiers at the time. Started off with a team of 120 juniors here in Washington, where I live. And several of them went on to compete at the World Cup and Olympic level. And I've coached a number of... World Cup skiers over the years, but I could then present to them this same intellectual framework. I don't do it so much with the high school kids, because many of them are not at all receptive to that. They just want to go ski, and that's fine. But when you get a high level athlete that's curious, I could say, okay, here's why we're going to progress your training in this manner. Here's how we're going to move from, you know, where you are today and how we're going to get you to this place. And here's the things we need to work on in order to do that. It's not just going to say, okay, you need to go out and do this type of interval training. I wanted to have them understand it. And so over the course of doing that for almost 20 years, I got pretty good at explaining it to these people. And I got more refined in my way of explaining these notions. Some of these that are a little more, I mean, none of them are, you know, super challenging scientifically, but some of them do require you to be able to hold several thoughts in your brain at once and then put all these pieces together later. So it's not trivial, and it's not intuitive. But by putting this intellectual framework together, I could kind of present that to these athletes and say, here's what you're doing, and here's why, and here's what's going to happen as we do this. And that was during that same 20-year period when I started working with Steve. Because, you know, his coaching Steve and mm-hmm. coaching the cross-country skiers ran in parallel.
Right. And so I'm curious, you know, do you have, like, I guess, key points, or maybe, you know, like the Cliff Notes summary of this intellectual framework to break it down for, you know, of what it comes down to for you?
Yeah, it's only 464 pages long, but yes. No, that being somewhat facetious, but unfortunately, this is the trick, is because it's an intellectual framework, you have to construct it from the bottom up.
Right.
And what a lot of people do when they approach their training for endurance sports is they want to start at the top down. They want to go, okay, well, Mo Farah did this workout before he won 2 gold medals in the last Olympics. He did this series of workouts over the last, you know, 8 weeks before the Olympics. So I'm just going to copy those because it worked for him. Well, and that's the top-down approach. But what people aren't recognizing is that, you know, it's all the other 15 years of training that Mo Farah did to get him to the point where he could even do that workout out and benefit from it, or those workouts and benefit from them, that are really the important part. That those last few weeks before the Olympics, it's just the frosting on the cake. That was not really what made him the athlete that he is. And so what this, when you start from the bottom up, you have to establish, first the person has to have at least a somewhat working understanding of the metabolism that goes on inside the muscle in order to produce energy. So they got to have a little basic physiology there. Nothing that you probably weren't already exposed to in high school. So it's not too daunting. And since I'm not a biochemist, I try to make it as understandable as possible. I use metaphors to try to show how things connect. But without that understanding of the physiological workings of the muscle, it's really important, or it's really difficult to talk about methodologies of training. Like, well, why do you go out and do these long, slow runs? What is that doing for you? I mean, so we start from this very base level of developing an understanding of the physiology. Then we start talking about all the various methodologies that are involved in training for endurance, the different things that have been tried, you know, the reason you do it this way, and you do this before you do that. And then eventually in the book, we work into actually how to put all this together into a plan for yourself. So that's, I guess, that's the cliff notes on right. how this works. So, but as I say, it takes hundreds of pages to really flesh it out and right. make it so that it's that the framework has some meat hanging on the frame, on the skeleton, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And so what would you say that training is to you, Scott? Like, what does it come down to? What does it mean, that word, in terms of applying it to successful?
It's a great question, because I think there's a really common misconception about what training is. Most people consider randomized exercise as training. Like, they get up in the morning and they go out the door and they do what they feel like doing on that particular day. And that's kind of what I do now, because I'm not an athlete. And it's great for health, and it's much lower stress. And you will see gains with it up to a point, at which point the gains won't come anymore. And the difference between that and training is that training is a structured and progressive approach to move you from where you are today to where you want to be at some time in the future in preparation for a particular goal. So when you take an athlete that is goal-oriented, or big race coming up, or maybe it's a whole season of cross-country ski races that they need to be in shape for, then it's pretty easy to say, okay, here's the structure, and here's how it's got to progress. And that this progression notion is really critical. It's one of the things that doesn't happen in the random exercise approach, is that as you become fitter, it takes a bigger training stimulus to elicit some new and improved adaptations to make you fitter and faster. So if you just go out the door and run 5 miles at the same pace every single day, if you're new to it, yeah, over the first 2 or 3 months, you're going to probably see some pretty dramatic gains. But eventually, what was perhaps even an overwhelming stress to your body will suddenly become something that's not even enough of a stress to elicit a training response. And so we have to have this progression, which always is raising the bar in front of the athlete. It's like, okay, last week you did blah, blah, blah. Well, the easy way to think of this is, let's say, with strength training. So if you want to deadlift 300 pounds, you can't just go into the gym every day and deadlift 50 pounds more. Just do more repetitions with it. You won't get to that 300 pounds. You've got to keep literally raising the bar. You've got to add more weight onto the bar and keep lifting it, and you will adapt over time given the right protocol. I mean, you can't just go indefinitely, and your body has to be able to handle the training load. So training causes a temporary crisis state in the muscles. They are shocked by whatever you've just done to them, and they go, whoa, we got to get better at this, so that the next time he makes us do this, we're not so pathetic. And, you know, if you give it an, if after impl- applying a training stress, you give your body a time to adapt to it, the next time you do that thing, it's going to be stronger, provided it's not, you know, 4 weeks down the road. So I would say progression is really the key, mm-hmm. and having this goal and the structure, knowing that, okay, Tuesday's workout's going to look like this, and Wednesday's going to look like this, and Thursday's going to look like that. And there's, of course, going to be variation because we're not machines, and there's going to be good days and bad days. And, you know, maybe you had to stay up late for a test, or you got in a fight with your wife or whatever that causes this other stress, and you need to be able to change and fine tune the training. But at least there's a structured plan that's laid out that shows you, it's kind of a roadmap to get to where you want to go.
Right. And so how did you, you know, 20 or however many, you know, 20 years ago, start to apply this framework to Steve's training, Steve's journey, and help him, you know, progress in his climbing journey?
Well, one of the other things that training has, that is important with training, is that it's individualized. Mm-hmm. So each person is going to be bringing something different to their training. Everything from genetics. Their genetics play a role, but it's a role that we can't influence. So while it's important to understand the genetics of athlete, I mean, is this athlete a fast twitch dominant muscle fiber person, or are they a slow twitch dominant? That's going to affect how you prescribe their training. The big thing that we really want to dig into is their training history. What have they been doing for these last 10 years or last 6 weeks? Those kinds of things. We want to know what their training history is, because that's going to also inform how we move forward. And so then what I do, like with Steve, is we look for the low-hanging fruit. Like, what do you suck at? What are you not good at? Because it's a lot easier to improve your weakness than it is to improve your strengths. And most of us gravitate towards training our strengths because it's more fun. I mean, like, oh, I'm good at this, so I'm just going to go out and do this kind of run all the time because it feels really good and it satisfies my ego. But what most of us need to do is, like, that run should be dropped. That particular type of run should go down to maybe a maintenance level where it's once every 6 or 7 or 10 days. And you should be going, okay, the things I really suck at are this, this, and this. And I need to start including those components. Those qualities need to fit into my training, because if I elevate those qualities, chances are my overall performance will go up, because my performance is being held back, not by my strengths, but by my weaknesses. So with Steve, I began to look at, okay, what are the qualities that make up his sport, his event? And, you know, they're pretty simple. He needs to be able to hike uphill fast with a heavy pack for hours and hours at a time without getting tired. And again, that's the base work that he needs to do. It's not really for Steve, who climbs at a very, very high, and especially at the height of his career, he was climbing at an extremely high level, you know, technically very demanding stuff. So lots of strength and coordination, muscular endurance, that kind of stuff. But if he got tired on the approach to the more challenging parts of the climb, then it wouldn't matter that he could climb well, because he'd be too tired to perform well it would be like, you know, if you're in an ultra running race and you have a great finishing kick, you know you can take anybody in the last mile. But by the time you get to that last mile, you're so exhausted, it doesn't matter, because that kick is gone.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have that kick. So the same thing for Steve. If, you know, if he's on an 8,000-meter peak in the Karakoram range in Pakistan, and he's been climbing for 3 days, and it's on, you know, moderately demanding technical terrain, where endurance and fitness are really the most important things, and then finally he gets to the crux of the climb, but he's so wasted from all this other effort that he can't perform anywhere near his potential on the crux, that it doesn't matter how good a climber he is anymore, because he's going to have to turn around and go down. So we worked a lot on that base fitness for him. He was already technically climbing very well, so we only did sort of what we did maintenance work and the technical stuff. So we spent a lot of time working on specific strengths and basic endurance. It was, you know, it's not rocket science, especially for a sport like that where you're, you know, the whole sport is moving uphill slowly, mm-hmm. for a long, yeah. time. You know, speed doesn't factor in. It's not like, you know, even a 50K running race, speed can play a role there. You know, somebody who's, you know, we might not think of it because, you know, whether or not running very fast, running 8-minute miles or something like that doesn't seem very fast, but somebody who's comfortable running 7:30s versus somebody who's comfortable running 8 minutes, that's going to make a big difference right. over the course of those 30 kilometers right. or 50 kilometers.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It definitely, you know, all you've been saying makes so much sense to me because it's things that I've, you know, read or seen, but to you to put it, you know, clearly and understandably, I guess, in the way to look at training, it's been very interesting to hear because it's things that I've thought about before, but never in the you know, in kind of a concrete way, like what you've been saying and what I was reading in preparation for our conversation today as well, made so much sense about how, you know, how I look at my training, but also how I can improve how I look at my training and how I actually execute it. And that's what I've noticed too, at least in my own athletics, is like building a self-awareness, listening to your body and understanding how to, like, you know, recognize, like you were saying, what you're weak at, what you're good at, and kind of work towards learning how to see where you're at and see where you can go forward, I think is also very important.
Exactly. And that can be a challenge doing on your own. It often helps to right. have a coach for that very reason, because now you've got this objective third party who's not in your head anymore. Whereas when you're trying to, I mean, self-coaching is really hard. Even super high level athletes who, they know what the heck they're doing. But they want coaching, not because they don't really know what to do. They want somebody to tell them what not to do. Yeah. Like, oh, hey, you need to rest today. Or maybe we should try this. Or have you thought about doing that? And like, so when I'm coaching, you know, beginner type folks, or let's say my junior cross country skiers, which I don't do anymore, but I did for a long time, it's really a top down command system. You know, I'm the font of all the knowledge, and I just tell them what to do because they don't have any concept of what should be done. And in most cases, when you have low level beginners and that sort of thing, is that they're going to respond well to almost any structured program. It's pretty hard to do bad things to people who aren't very fit. But as the athlete gets fitter and fitter, it gets harder and harder to find new ways to improve their fitness. And when you're taking, you know, an Olympic level athlete who's been at this for 15, 20 years, it can be a bit of a challenge to dig around and find out, okay, well, how can we make you faster? What can we do that will make you faster? And so there's a lot of out of the box thinking. I've done all kinds of crazy things with athletes in order to elicit, you know, better training response out of them. And in those cases, it becomes much more of a partnership and a collaboration. So the coach and the athlete it's no longer the coach on the top and the athlete down below. They're on the same level and they're back and forth, you know, discussing ideas, trying things, changing them together. It's much more intellectually challenging and interesting for the coach, I think, at that point, because they're having to, you know, they're pushing their own frontiers of knowledge. And, you know, and they might say, hey, this worked with so-and-so 3 years ago. We did this before World Championships and we got a really good response. Let's try that. Or maybe we should modify it like this because you're not quite you know, you're a different athlete in this way. And so I think that becomes really fun for the coach. That's what I really enjoy. And mm-hmm. so with Steve, because he was already at a very, very high level, it was, you know, fun because we could take, you know, really what I did with Steve, there's nothing new in either of our books that we've written about this. There is very much, all we've done is repurpose conventional sports knowledge to these somewhat unconventional activities. And so all of these ideas, whether it was, you know, training Steve to hike uphill a long time without getting tired, or get a cross-country skier to ski faster in a 3-minute sprint race, was taking what we know from swimming and cycling and running sports, which have all been studied for 100 years extensively, and saying, okay, how do we apply that to ultra running or mountaineering or cross country skiing? And the information was out there. It just took a little bit of kind of outside the box thinking to repurpose that knowledge so that it could be used in an unconventional way.
And sometimes just looking at something so simple of just repurposing knowledge can be so impactful because it's nobody else was really looking at it that way. And being able to do that and, you know, can change so much because, like I said, like nobody else really was. And that's really what was, you know, fascinating to me about training for the new alpinism and about uphill athlete is what you guys did with just that little shift of perspective, but how much it can, you know, improve and help all these athletes out there.
Yeah, and it, you know, it wasn't, can I tell you, do we have enough time? I can tell you a quick little story about training for the new alpinism.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So Steve and I did not think that we would be able to sell a book like this. So I was in Norway on the World Cup, not as an athlete, but as a coach with some skiers. I think it was in 2011, maybe. And Steve and I were Skyping back and forth. And he said, you know, because he was on a book tour with his first book, which was called Beyond the Mountain. It's a memoir about his climbing career. And he said, everywhere I go, the most common question is, how did you train to do all this stuff? And he developed kind of a glib one-liner, which was, well, I can tell you, but it would take a whole book. So when we were having this Skype conversation, he says, I think we should write down what we did for training and put this out there. And I poo-pooed it. I said, who cares? I mean, there, you know, alpinism is such a tiny little niche sport. Nobody's going to care. And, you know, no alpinist. Do you know any climbers that train? No, other than rock climbers, but you know, no alpinists were actually involved in training at that time, outside of perhaps Uli Steck. He was probably the only one. And so I thought we would be really lucky to sell 1,000 copies. And so I'm envisioning this 100-page stapled in the corner pamphlet thing that we hand out to our buddies. and that's the way it started. And then the more we wrote, the more we realized we had to say, and it was, I'm sure you may have had this experience of writing papers at school, when you have to sit down and craft a good argument and explain yourself in writing, that's an incredibly good teaching opportunity, a learning opportunity for yourself.
Yes.
And so, you know, when I had to sit down and realize I'm going to be telling this to people who don't have this background knowledge that I have, and I had to do a lot more reading and research and figure out making sure I was saying it the right way. I wasn't getting things wrong. And in that process, I realized, oh, this is what we've been doing. We're just using these same old principles that we used for swimming. Now we're just reusing them here. And it was only through that writing process that it really became clear to me what we were doing. And at the, again, like I said, at the time, we had no idea that this would take hold. It has taken a hold, as evidenced by the fact that we've now sold about 60,000 of Training for the New Alpinism, and our business with Uphill Athlete has been booming, and everywhere I go, I hear about people talking about training for mountaineering and climbing and that sort of thing, which we didn't used to hear. So I think it has had an impact, which I'm glad, because one of the first things that Steve and I said to ourselves when we started this project is, well, maybe we can change the conversation a little bit. So it does seem like we've done that, and I think that that's a good thing. Not that everybody needs to embrace this sort of regimented, structured training. It's not for everybody. I would be the first one to admit. I mean, as I just said, I don't do it myself anymore. I did it when I did it, but I did it for 30 years, so I got, you know, I got used to it. But some people just want to go climbing, or they just want to go for a long run in the mountains. And I say more power to you. That's great. I have no qualms about people choosing that avenue. And if that's what makes them satisfied, then that's great. However, if you have higher aspirations, or if you stagnated and you want to know how to get better, what we've put together here is a way to show you how it can work. You know, here's what you could do if you chose to do it.
Right.
Not that this is the only path. It's not the only path. It's just one path that we know works quite well.
Right. Yeah. And just showing that perspective, giving that option, and obviously resonates with people because people are buying the book and people are signing up for Uphill Athlete. So I have three motivationals, as I call them, three like quick little questions that I like to finish the show off with, but they're still, to me, pretty important. So I think they're good cappers for our conversation. And so the first one is, what are your favorite books? What, you know, books that have impacted you and shaped you and, you know, influenced you?
Well, you know, I'm an engineer, so I'm afraid that my book, my library, which is extensive, it was probably not your typical person's library. I mean, I have Mark's Handbook of Mechanical Engineering, which is, you know, like a 1,500-page book sitting on my desk. So I'm not a fiction reader. I very rarely read fiction. I have read it on a few expeditions when I've been trapped in a camp and needed a diversion. But my personal feeling about reading is that, you know, I want to read something that teaches me something that I don't know, and about the human experience, which I feel there's so much relevant and incredible information out there in the nonfiction world, whether it's memoirs and histories or technical manuals. But a lot of my reading, of course, especially over the last several years, has been in the sports science area. And I will tell you, though, that I think in that genre, which, again, I'm not the best guy to ask about reading material. this is not bedside reading that I'm talking about here. But for people that are interested in delving into, you know, the science of this kind of stuff and wanting to dig deeper, I believe that Steve Magnus's book called The Science of Running is perhaps one of the best out there for getting a good understanding of especially running training, but, you know, endurance training in general. It's self-published, which was a little unfortunate because he didn't have a good editor, so there's lots of typos in it. But Steve is a great intellect and has a lot of information to share. Another book that I refer to frequently is a book by a former Soviet exercise scientist and coach named Yuri Verkhoshansky. And Verkhoshansky is pretty much the granddaddy of all we know about modern strength training. And he's the inventor of plyometrics, for instance, as one example. Oh, okay. And he wrote quite a few books. He's not a native English speaker, and he didn't really get published at all in the West until after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. And so he was unknown, but he'd been flourishing in the Soviet Union for, you know, 30 plus years before that as a really high level coach. And one of my favorite books is called The Special Strength Training Manual for Coaches. And if a person, and it's by Verkhoshansky, you can order it off of Amazon, or his daughter runs a website. If you just Google Verkhoshansky, which is a little bit difficult to spell for you, it goes way down some very deep rabbit holes on training theory, despite the title, it's not just about strength training. There is probably a quarter of the book that's devoted to training for endurance sports that is really illuminating. So those would be my two recommendations, I guess, for books in this genre, a genre that I think I'm kind of well-versed in.
Okay, I will definitely have to check those out. They seem fascinating. I've heard of, I don't think, either of them, so I will have to pick those up. So do you do any meditation?
I have tried. I wish I could, honestly. I'm a failed meditator. The closest I come is that I spend quite a bit of time doing yoga type. I won't call it yoga because I can't call myself a yogi in any sense of the word. I'm not even a very good yoga practitioner, but I do quite a lot of rehabilitative, restorative work just because I'm old and really beat up after all these years. So, you know, whether it's stretching, rolling on a ball or a foam roller, and for me, that's kind of my meditation time, if you could call it that. I know it's also quite physical, so it probably doesn't really qualify as meditation. I have done it. I was in the 70s. I was involved in a transcendental meditation study that went on for months, and I reaped huge benefits from that. And I think it was a really fascinating experience. I'm really intrigued by meditation. I just haven't had the discipline, frankly, to do it. So I use my, you know, a lot of times when I'm out for long runs or skis in the mountains, and by myself, that is, you know, kind of a time where I'm removed from normal world. I know true meditators would say that's not meditation, and I understand that because I've done the meditation thing. But so no, I'm not a meditator. I wish I was.
Do you think it's something you want to work towards at some point in your life, continuing, or do you think it's just not?
I think it's a great aspiration, and I hope that at some point in my life I have the wherewithal, you know, it's probably motivation and discipline in order to make yourself do it.
As is most things.
And I'm like most, one of the problems I think for a lot of endurance sports athletes is we are type A personalities, and it is very hard for us to sit still and just tune out and turn off. You know, my brain's going 100 miles an hour, and I'm sure yours does too. And
yeah.
Trying to quiet it down, I know would be a good thing. It's just so much effort, and because I'm realizing when I'm doing that, I'm not doing all these other things I could be doing, whether it's out for a run or climbing or working on the business or reading a book. I wish I had a better answer for you. I mean, I do agree that it's a great thing, and I wish I could do more of it.
Right. Well, at least like we were talking about earlier, you're aware, self-aware of the goal and something to work towards at some point, hopefully down the road. So what are some key tips or techniques, I guess is one way to put it, that, you know, the listeners today can take away from what you've learned in terms of, you know, training, in terms of athletic progression, and just working towards their goals that they have set out for them? If you had some, you know, I guess the bullet points, which aren't always the best, but if you had to give some.
No, there are definitely some. So I think that one thing to keep in mind is that every good training program needs to have three qualities to it. It needs to be, you need to have continuity in it. In other words, you can't have big gaps. You know, you can't train on Monday and then not train again until Thursday if you hope to see gains. So you have to have this continuity. And it needs to be progressive, which we've already covered, and it needs to have modulation. In other words, it needs to have periods of overload and then periods of lower load where your body can adapt. It can't just be constantly piling on more work. So it has to be modulated, and that modulation can take place, you know, within a day or within several days or within several weeks. And modulation in a good training plan will be built into the plan so that perhaps, you know, week one is at a certain level, week two is a little bit higher level, week three pushes you to, again, a higher level, and then week four, the training load drops dramatically in order to allow your body to absorb all that work that you've done. So I think keeping those three qualities in mind for a training plan is really key. I think individuality of training is something that is not taken into consideration enough, which is why when you open either of our books, you don't find stock plans. And there's not just a plan to go run such and such a race or to climb such and such a mountain. And that would be an easy way to do it, but we're sort of philosophically opposed to that notion. What we wanted to do with these books was to give people the tools to construct their own plan that fits them, based on the knowledge that they're getting. You know, the first half of the book is all about giving you the knowledge to understand how to do this. Then the second half of the book is to tell you how to actually put the plan together. Because too many people try to just copy what somebody else does or say, oh, I found this training plan on the website, on the internet, and I'm just going to use that. And a lot of that, I think, comes from the notion, like I mentioned very early in our conversation, is let's look at what a world champion did and just copy that world champion's training. That's one of the worst mistakes any endurance athlete could make, because you're not that world champion. You don't have those 15 years of high level training. And so there's a good likelihood that's not going to work for you. And there's some likelihood it's actually going to make you worse because it's going to exhaust you. So I think this individuality would be maybe the other real important bullet point, which, again, is why we put so much emphasis on the educational components of both the books.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for coming on the show today, Scott. I had a blast chatting with you, and Man, that, I learned a lot, actually, and I just, yeah, thank you for coming on, and thanks for making the time.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoyed
it. Thanks, Jared. I really appreciate your reaching out to Steve and myself. It was fun for me. You sound like yourself a very interesting young man. I mean, just from what you wrote to me in your first email, I'm impressed.
Thank you.
And you sound like you have a lot going on for yourself. When are you graduating from school?
I'm a second year, so another couple years.
A couple more years.
Yeah.
And what are you studying?
Journalism. Journalism.
Cool. Well, and so this is a perfect way for you to practice your craft.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, I've done a number of podcasts. You're very good at this.
Thank you. That means a lot. Yeah. That really does. Yeah. Because I don't want to make it awkward or uncomfortable or tedious for the guests. So thank you.
No, you did a great job. I really appreciate you taking the time to interview Steve and myself.
And that was that, episode 179 of the Touching the Trail podcast with this week's guest, Scott Johnston. If you want to find out more about what Scott is up to, you can head on over to uphillathlete.com and you can look up Training for the New Alpinism and Training for the Uphill Athlete wherever books are sold. If you want to find out more about what Touching the Trail is up to, you can head over to touchingthetrail.com, where you can read the writings, you can read the resources on meditation, on food, and on recommended readings, and you can sign up for the newsletter. If you ever have any questions or comments, or if you just want to talk, you can always reach out to me via the contact page on the website, and you can follow us on social media at Touching the Trail on Instagram, at Touch the Trail on Twitter, and the Touching the Trail page on Facebook. If you haven't done so already, make sure to subscribe to the show and make sure to share it out with your friends and your family and your coworkers and everyone else. And if you're loving the show every week, please leave a review. It really does help and it lets me know that you're out there and that you're listening and that you're loving what I do. If you want to help support Touching the Trail, you can go to touchingthetrail.com/donate to donate to the show, and you can do however much you want. But as I've said many times before, this show is built and based in the Buddhist concept of dana, of generosity, of giving. And so I cannot continue to improve and to grow what I do here without your help. So please consider a donation. You can also go to targetreleaserecovery.com, where you can pick up your very own Basecamp and Peak. Now these are functional, affordable, unique, and handmade, handheld deep tissue massage tools. And all of those links are in the show notes. And so going forward this week, just remember the three aspects of training, plans that Scott calls as some of the most important that you need to keep in mind as you approach a new training plan, training regimen, as you approach your training. And the first one being continuity, consistency with your training. The second one being that there needs to be progression, there needs to be a build. And the third being that there needs to be modulation. So there needs to be periods where you're working real hard and periods where you're not working as hard. And as always, please remember to go far, go further. And next week, I will be featuring my interview with Steve House. So it will be a nice pairing with this week's interview with Scott Johnston. So look forward to that. And I will see you all next week on the Touching the Trail podcast. Thanks for listening. The Touching the Trail podcast.